So we're here at the first class of relativity. This is kind of an unusual lecture in that it's not going to be focused on kind of a bunch of derivations. Instead, I kind of want to give you an overview of how relativity fits together and what are the important features of relativity and kind of where we're going to end up. So in terms of kind of an outline, we're going to start by taking a look at the equations that I think you probably have run into in modern. So the basis for these equations is something that is fundamental, and I hope I don't need to define it again, and that's the idea of a reference frame. So what we mean by a reference frame is basically a set of XYZ axes and clocks that you can measure events, that is to say locations and times, in. And of course, such reference frames can be rotated with respect to each other, they can be moving relative to each other, and those are all things we're going to want to consider. So one of the kind of odd features that I think needs to be explained a little bit is why it is that basically everything that was in Einstein's 1905 paper was done by other people first, and nevertheless why we do think of Einstein as the author of relativity. So the kind of the methods that are used in the introductory chapters to derive these sort of equations from modern are surprisingly easy. Just pretty much just algebra and using what I'll call Galilean invariance in order to calculate these results. And it must be that there's kind of more behind relativity than these sort of equations. And we're going to want to explore kind of what is more fundamentally relativity about. And that's going to turn out to depend on a four-dimensional space, which is called Minkowski space. Now, the reason that relativity exists has to be kind of the timing and existence of it has to be kind of laid to the feet of Maxwell, and so we're going to want to explain Maxwell's equations that determine electricity and magnetism. And what's important about Maxwell's work is that for a huge amount of time, these were the only true fundamental equations. And it's certainly the case that Maxwell kind of didn't recognize what he had, and it took a good bit of time in order to do that. But conceivably, the history of physics would be different if Maxwell wrote down his equations and then said by Galilean invariance, these same equations have to apply to any reference frame. But he didn't, and so it took some time to realize that for the people to know what they got. So four vectors, Minkowski space, is kind of the important feature of relativity. But in order, I think, to understand what's going on, we're going to want to go back and talk some about normal vectors, three-dimensional vectors, and how all of those things kind of fit together. Okay, so with that kind of outline as to where we want to go, let's take a look at these basic kind of equations from modern. So it turns out that the speed of light is the maximum possible velocity, and so it makes sense to look at what fraction of the speed of light something is moving at. And the kind of universal symbol for that is beta. And the velocity of light is high, and so most commonly we're going to have very small betas. So the fastest thing, that's the fastest man-made object, is the Parker Solar Probe, which was basically dropped into the sun, which is how it got going so fast, and it had a beta of about 10 to the minus 3. About the best we can do on Earth is on the order of 10 to the minus 4, and the speed of sound is about 10 to the minus 3. So another kind of way of getting a handle on how big the speed of light is to realize that approximately speaking, the speed of light is equal to g times 1 year. Okay, so if you could make a rocket ship that could accelerate at g for a year, you would get up to a good fraction of the speed of light. Okay, so if you look at most of the equations we've written down, the surprising feature only happens if gamma is not equal to 1. Right? If gamma is equal to 1, then there's no surprise. We learn that the objects don't change, length and time runs the same. And gamma, in some sense, is a good measure of how things deviate from typical sort of Newtonian points of view. And since betas are typically small, it might be helpful to kind of tailor expand that formula for gamma. And so you realize that for, you know, kind of at best, gamma is going to deviate from 1 for a macroscopic object on the order of a part in a million. And you know, it takes a lot of great measurement in order to measure things that are that small. On the other hand, it is possible to accelerate non-man-made objects to pretty high speeds. And you can kind of see what's going to be required if you think about that c is equal to g times a year. So if we want to get something to move fast on the order of c, we could accelerate it at g. If we could accelerate it at g, it would take a year. And if we believe kind of Newtonian physics, it would be half a light year out, so you couldn't do it on Earth. If you want to try and do it faster, you're going to make the time shorter, you're going to have to make the g bigger. So if you wanted to accelerate something to on the order of the speed of light in a second, it's going to take as many seconds as there are in a year, which is about 30 million g. And human body is okay for short, at least for short periods of time, at g equals 10 gravities. My guess is that something like this watch is probably good to 100 g, but 30 million G is going to destroy most any man-made object. So if you're going to make something go very, very fast, it's going to have to be very robust. So nuclei, for example, are very strongly held together, and the RIC accelerator is designed to accelerate nuclei out to pretty big to pretty high energies, pretty high velocities, to gammas that are on the order of 100. And that might be useful to rewrite this equation, at least approximately so, in terms of gammas. So if we have a gamma of 100, then we're going to get basically 4 nines, 0.999, for our corresponding velocities. The Large Hadron Collider can push gammas to about 10,000, and so going to have even more nines. Electrons, which seem to be indestructible, have been accelerated to almost 10 to the fifth for gamma. So huge numbers of nines. So if we can we can get to numbers that are incredibly close to a beta equals one, but those things are going to have to be God-made objects as opposed to man-made objects. So, what happens at these high speeds? Well, time dilation is, I'm sure, one that you've heard about, that moving clocks run slow. So that if a, and we'll typically be talking about trains and moving at high speeds just because, well, just because we're not Galileo. So Galileo talked about boats moving smoothly at high speed, miles per hour. But we're going to want incredible trains, which as we've described as man-made objects, we couldn't accelerate to those speeds. But in any case, what time dilation says is that a clock that's on a fast-moving train is going to run slow. And it's going to run slow according to gamma. So if we're talking about, you know, 100-mile-an-hour, 200-mile-an-hour trains, boy, it's going to be a very small effect. On the other hand, physicists are really good at measuring time and frequency. Tremendous, incredible, you know, 14-digit accuracy is kind of possible. So I don't know, maybe 50 years ago, people put atomic clocks on airplanes, and just at a few hundred miles an hour, they could see differences between the rate at which the atomic clocks were running in the airplanes and what the atomic clocks were running with on the ground. And you may know that GPS, where we have satellites that are moving relatively fast, are extremely accurate measurements of time. And those things have to be corrected, both for special relativity and it turns out, general relativity. It turns out that clocks also run slow if they're deep in a gravitational field. So that fast-moving train is also going to appear shorter than it would normally. So the height of the cars isn't going to change, but the length of the train is going to change according to Lorentz contraction, again by this factor of gamma. It might be useful for stop and take a look at the word that is often described, used to describe these phenomena, and that is appears, that the train clocks in a train appear to run slow, or that the train appears to be shorter. And I think that the use of the word appears is just because it is so nonsensical, so different from our human experience, which is, of course, based on gammas that are basically one, that we're unwilling to say is. But is the correct statement. These things really are any imaginable measurement of these phenomena are going to show that the objects are compressed along the direction of motion, so that a disk, for example, would look like an oval crushed in the direction of motion, and that moving clocks run slow. So I was emphasizing a moment ago about how this could be tested with macroscopic clocks, but nuclei particles have half-lives, and it's very easy to see huge enhancement. As you've seen, you can have gammas of 100 and 10,000, etc. You can get huge expanses on lifetimes of particles if they're moving fast. So the one equation here that doesn't have a gamma in it, and hence I would say is the most interesting of these equations, the one that best is associated with the idea of relativity, is the idea that the existence of simultaneity is relative. So what this means, for example, is if the people on the train have very carefully synchronized their clocks so that they all strike noon at exactly the same time, if we were to look at those clocks sitting by the side of the tracks, they would not look to be in synchronous. and it would appear as if the clock that's in the caboose is a little bit ahead of the clock that's in the engine. And this would be in addition to the clocks running slow. So both the clock in the engine and in the clock in the caboose would be slowed at exactly the same amount. So this difference isn't going to increase or decrease. It's going to be a constant. So I don't know, these three equations are ones that I'm happy to describe as correct. But the next equation, the idea that mass depends on velocity, I'm not happy with. So when I told Todd that I was going to tell you that this equation is wrong, he had the right response. Well, what's the definition of wrong? So we would often say, based on Einstein's revisions, that Newton was wrong, right? That Newton didn't have things exactly correct. But of course, when you apply Newton to everyday objects even with excellent precision, Newton's law seemed to be obeyed. So they're wrong, but approximately right. And that's not what I'm talking about. So what I mean by wrong is that the concepts are not useful. So you're certainly free to define mass as a function of velocity. Nothing keeps you from doing that. But I claim that that's not a useful thing to do. So to me, mass is something you can write down in a book. And it's the same for moving objects and not moving objects. It's what's called an invariant. The same number applies, whether it's moving or not. But something is changing with velocity, and I'm happiest to basically multiply this by c squared. And throughout the middle piece, because it implies that that's throwing out the equation that is usually associated with Einstein as being wrong, throughout the middle piece of this, and then we have something that makes sense. So anyone would say that energy depends on velocity, right? Kinetic energy. And if we expand out the gamma factor here, we see that, according to this equation, approximately, just to second order in beta, the energy consists of a huge constant and kinetic energy. And that huge constant, according to Newton, you could add a constant to energy and it doesn't change anything, right? You need changes in energy to get kind of corresponding effects. Energy is only defined up to a constant. In terms of Newton. And so here, the presence of this big constant doesn't really affect things. So I'm happiest with this because it makes perfect sense. Energy depends on velocity, but mass is some sort of constant. Okay, so the next piece I wanted to kind of point out is that none of these equations have Einstein's name on them. And that's because basically all of the results in 1905 Einstein's paper were derived by other people first. And boy, that sounds like we're misattributing the Nobel Prize for Einstein, which of course he in fact didn't get for relativity. So what's kind of going on there? So first of all, the most kind of concise statement about relativity is that the equations of physics don't depend at all on the velocity of the reference frame. So that you could write down Maxwell's equations exactly in the form that's on my shirt, and they would be applicable in the train and on the side of the road. And of course, that's simply a restatement of Galilean invariance. And so Galileo famously had discussions with Aristotelians. The Aristotelians would claim that if you dropped a rock from the top of a mast on a ship, it would land behind the mast. It would fall behind. And he said, not so. Works exactly the same as if the ship is at rest. The rock falls straight down. So why did it become news to repeat Galileo's statements 300 years later? Well, the important guy here is Maxwell. So Maxwell's equation, these equations, Maxwell developed in papers in 1861, 1865, that is to say, kind of Civil War era, and in 1873 he wrote a textbook on this. Oddly enough, our book has a sentence that starts in 1887, Maxwell did, and he was dead in 1887, so he wasn't doing a whole lot. So why did we throw out Galilean invariance after Maxwell? Well, so let's kind of back up for a second on the equations of physics all being the same on in any frame of reference. So in 191, you were told about velocity addition formula, and it seems to be a proof, right? So if the caboose moves 30 meters in 1 second, and a baseball from the back of the caboose moves 20 meters per second forward, then according to the guy sitting on the side of the road, the ball has moved 50 meters in 1 second, so that we can add the velocity of the train to the velocity of the baseball to get the velocity relative to the train. But if we try that with light, we come to the conclusion that the guy on the side of the road is going to measure light moving at 30 meters a second faster than the guy in the train. And so the proposal that the speed of light is a constant has to screw up ideas about space and time in order to make it work. So one kind of dramatic way to do this is to think about two frames of reference that are coincident at time equals zero, and of course one of them is the train is moving forward at some corresponding speed. So if when the origins are coincidental, a flash bulb goes off, then the guy sitting on the side of the road says, the flash bulb sitting here went off, and so there is now a sphere of light that is expanding at the speed of light. And of course, the caboose isn't moving as fast as the speed of light, so it's over there. So the center of this sphere is this spot here. And if you think about it, the guy in the train is going to say exactly the same thing. The guy in the caboose says the flash of light happened here, so there's a sphere of light that has expanded, and the tracks were moving backwards, but not at the speed of light, so its point is there. So how can it be that, according to observers on the track, the sphere is centered on a fixed point on the track, and according to the guy in the caboose, the sphere is centered on a point that's fixed in the caboose. So something has to be kind of screwed up in order to make that work out. Okay, so getting back to Maxwell, when Maxwell was working, the only waves that were recognized were waves that were in media, sound waves, water waves, etc. So he certainly started out thinking very mechanically about what the media was that in which the light was propagating. And it had to be a very ghostly kind of material because it couldn't be pumped out of vacuum chambers. It seems to move through solid walls just fine. But in any case, he developed his whole theory based on the existence of this material. And in the end, he got these equations, these Maxwell's equations. And he had derived them thinking about this material, and he therefore said nothing about how things would look if you were moving relative to it. So the history of physics would be different if he said, yeah, I've derived these equations for this media, but according to Galilean invariance, these same equations should apply on the moving train. So the opposite point of view, that things are different, of course, would apply to sound waves, right? Sound waves, if you, in this sort of experiment, if you make out a set of sound waves, they're going to be centered on where the firecracker is. So if the firecracker is moving, it doesn't matter. It's still going to be centered on the where the firecracker was at that time in the rest frame of the air. Okay, so what we've said is that the solution to many of these problems are going to be solved by thinking about space and time as a four-dimensional object. So this is Minkowski space, in which space and time are put together, and we can talk about space-time. And if we're talking about a location, we're now talking about three spatial coordinates and one time coordinate, a so-called event. So if we put space and time together as an object, it might be helpful to think about what we did when we just had space by itself, when we had three vectors as opposed to four vectors. Okay, so let's talk about three-dimensional space and vectors. So one thing that I should perhaps comment about is what Newton thought about as a vector was basically something like a pointy arrow. But he didn't really develop his ideas beyond those sort of basic geometry ideas, which are good. The idea of vectors really is a relatively recent idea. It dates to the same sort of time frame, circa 1900. So as a matter of fact, Maxwell never wrote down his equations in this sort of vector format. He wrote them down, well, in terms of quaternions, which I'm not going to explain. So the kind of special thing about vectors is that if we talk about the velocity in the x direction, we know that that's not a done deal, right? The velocity in the x direction depends on what is the x direction? If we choose a rotated coordinate system, we're going to get different values for the x velocity and the y velocity, etc. They change. So how exactly do they change? Well, it's, I think, useful to start out with just two dimensions, two spatial dimensions. So if we have new coordinates, x prime, y prime, they're related to the original x and y coordinates by a matrix. So cosine theta, sine theta, do matrix multiplication, which I remind you is kind of going over on the left and going down on the right. That's going to be the relationship between the coordinates in a rotated coordinate system. And it's just geometry. There isn't any physics that's involved in proving that relationship. So if the, and it would just be slightly more general, a 3x3 matrix as opposed to a 2x2, if we were talking about in three dimensions. And these 3x3 matrices, the general description of a rotation requires three Euler angles. It's mathematically complicated, even though it's still the same story. So if the coordinates change just based on geometry and in this sort of linear relationship, then the change in the coordinates are going to change in the exact same way. And according to Newton, time is universal. There's no difference between time in the moving train and other trains. So if we divide our change in positions by something that doesn't depend on position, we're going to get something, a velocity vector, that satisfies exactly the same transformation as the coordinates. And similarly, the acceleration. So the only fundamental equation for force that Newton had was the force of gravity, and of course that also depended on the coordinates. So forces, accelerations, velocities, all of those things, if you were to rotate the coordinate systems, would go in the same way. So if you had an equation that involved vectors, if you knew that it was true in one coordinate system, you knew it would be true in any of them, because the all that's happening is to multiply each side of the equation by the same matrix, and it's guaranteed to be true. Okay, so if we kind of go a step further, we've said that the velocity in the x direction depends on our coordinate system, but some things don't depend on the coordinate system, right? The speed doesn't depend on the orientation of the coordinate system, which is to say the dot product of the velocity vector with itself doesn't change. So if we are relating velocity vectors into two situations, the dot product, the speed, well, speed squared actually, of the velocity has to be the same in any coordinate system we choose. Now it might be worth commenting about how to write this thing in terms of matrix stuff, right? So the dot product can be written by taking the transpose of the vector and then just matrix multiplying it by the other vector. So what we've got here then is m v prime transpose m v prime, and if you remember that the transpose of the product is the product of the transpose in reverse order, so this is v prime transpose m transpose m v prime. So if this is going to be invariant, right, if this is going to equal to b prime dot v, this thing has to be equal to 1. That is to say, the transpose of the matrix has to be equal to the inverse. So matrices like this are called orthogonal. And I think the origin of the word orthogonal is if you look at a matrix as a sequence of columns, or the same thing that applies to rows, what this equation means is that if you dot this row with any of the other rows, you'll get 0 unless you've chosen the same row, in which case you'd get 1. Now there's another sort of transformation that isn't exactly a rotation that might be worth talking about. That's an inversion, right, where you take the axes and you run them all backwards. So that would be an M that looked like that. So the pure rotations and the rotations with an inverse turn out, they differ just by the determinant being plus 1 or the determinant being minus 1. It's pretty easy to show that for any orthogonal matrix, the determinant squared has to be 1. So the determinants that are plus 1 and the determinants that are minus 1 are kind of easily separated. So matrices that have a determinant plus 1 are called special. So what we have is special orthogonal matrices in 3 dimensions. And it's just a name. But let me take a little walk here that's not related to relativity, but is related to a whole bunch of Nobel Prizes in the last 50 years, and talk about these sorts of things more generally. So you know that if you have one rotation and you follow it by another rotation, it's exactly the same as a single combined rotation along a different axis. So the rotation operations are closed. Combine two rotations, you get another rotation. And they make a structure that's called mathematicians would call a group. And it's a group that depends on 3 continuous parameters, like the Euler angles. And groups like that are called Lie groups. So you can also have finite symmetries where, for example, a hexagon, you can't rotate it any old way, but just by a 60-degree increments to get the same thing back. And you can have reflection planes. So we can have finite groups like that, but this is a infinite group with 3 dimensions, so it's called the Lie group. Now you can imagine that the Euler angles for the first rotation and the Euler angles for the second rotation determine the Euler angles of the combined rotation, but boy, is it going to be a mess. So it turns out to be easier to think about infinitesimal rotations. So if you look at the group of infinitesimal rotations, what you're dealing with is what's called the Lie algebra. And mathematicians have studied Lie algebras, and they have classified all of the simple ones. So it turns out that all the possibilities of Lie algebras amount to special orthogonal rotations in even dimensions, special orthogonal relations in odd dimensions. Those turn out to be kind of fundamentally different. What are called symplectic matrices in even dimensions, and then special unitary matrices in any dimension. Okay, so these are just names of Lie groups, and now what I want to say is what's worth a bunch of Nobel Prizes is U1 cross SU2 cross SU3 describes the symmetries of the the three of four forces that we recognize, minus gravity, right? So the This represents the electricity and magnetism. This represents the so-called weak force. And this represents the strong nuclear force, or I would call it the color force. Okay, so that's just an aside, so that sometime in your life you have heard that magic combination of symbols means something important. Okay, so backing up, the idea is that the equations of physics have to be vector equations so that they're true in any old oriented coordinate system. Now we now want to augment that with the idea of what's called a boost. So a boost is a coordinate system where you're going to the train system. And we want to treat those all things as versions of the same thing. They all mix up space and time in a particular way. The spatial rotations, of course, don't mess with time. We've seen that the boost equations do mess up time. So we want to treat those all kind of as the same thing. So what are the matrix equations? What are the linear equations that show how space-time in one reference frame can be related to space-time in a different frame? So if you measure an event, that is to say a location and a time, in one system, what are the corresponding space and time numbers that describe that same event in another system? And it might be helpful to kind of go back and think about what Galileo would have said. So Galileo would have said that the distance along the railroad tracks is equal to the location of the caboose, which is moving at velocity v, plus the extra distance that the object is from the caboose. And of course, times would be exactly the same. So we've seen that we're going to need to add gammas to these things. And what we see in this lack of simultaneity is, similarly in terms of time, we've got time dilation, but now we see that in addition we've got this lack of synchronization going on. So these are the equations that Lorentz, again, not Einstein, wrote down to see how things would change in different coordinate systems. Now, I want to kind of back up to say, what's the difference between Einstein and all of these predecessors? So these same equations other people wrote down, but for those other people, the v was the velocity relative to the ether. And for Einstein, the ether didn't exist. It didn't make sense to talk about a velocity, only about a velocity relative to another system. And in that case, these velocities were that relative velocity, not some velocity relative to some universal rest frame. Okay, so if we're going to make a vector out of space and time, one characteristic of vectors is that they all have the same units. So if we multiply through stuff by c, we get something that we can now put together into something like a vector. So what we've got, if you take a look at it, is that sort of relationship. Okay, looks good. And of course we can, oops, I've dropped gammas here. And of course we can get the inverse relationship by just applying the inverse matrix, and of course the y and the z components just go along for the ride. Okay, so what we've done is great, but it will be helpful if we can kind of reuse the ideas that we got from spatial vectors. Is there some way we can make this vector look exactly like the three-dimensional vectors we had before? And if we're going to do that, what we need to have is that for three-dimensional vectors, it was, well, let me just use x as generic, it was x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared. And what's going to turn out is we're going to need minus x4 squared. So first of all, let's kind of take a look at the why that is. So we set up here that that r squared minus ct squared was the exact same quantity, zero, whether we were in this frame or that frame. So this is going to be the corresponding invariant. So if we're going to have orthogonal matrices, we need to somehow or other generate this minus sign, which seems to be there physically. And if you think about it, you could do that just by putting in some i's. So now the length of this vector is going to automatically generate the minus sign that we want. And we're going to have to, of course, distribute some some other i's other places, right? Because this thing needs now to have a minus I in it, and if you work it out, this thing needs to have a plus I in it. Okay, so now this is a, I wouldn't say a perfectly normal, but it's an orthogonal matrix. The transpose of it is the inverse, and we're kind of good to go. So in three-dimensional space, this tells us, of course, how the coordinates transform, and just as we said for spatial versions, if the coordinates transform in by this linear transformation, the change in coordinates are going to satisfy these same coefficients. And so if we take the change in coordinates and divide it by something that's invariant, we're going to get something we're going to call a four velocity, which transforms exactly by the same equation. If the equations of physics now just involve four vectors, we're now guaranteed that if this equation is true in one frame, it's true in another frame. So one of the things we're going to want to do, I claimed that these Maxwell equations were the same in a moving coordinate system as in a non-moving coordinate system. It's not at all obvious in this written form. So we're going to want to write this in terms of four vectors as opposed to vectors, so that it's obvious that if it's true in one set of coordinate system, it's going to be true in any other one. Okay, so that'll take us through kind of half the course. It turns out, well, it must seem pretty obvious that this adding this imaginary number is artificial. And artificial as it is, it works perfectly good, but it gets confusing. In quantum mechanics, you have things that are really eyes, as opposed to these kind of fake eyes. And You can do it. You can do quantum mechanics just fine in that sort of way. But then we're also going to want to deal with non-orthogonal axes. So in mechanics, you saw the power of being able to make up any old coordinate systems to solve problems. So instead of limiting ourselves to x, y, and z, we want to have any imaginable set of coordinates. And it becomes increasingly uncomfortable to try and write things down with this imaginary metric. The cost for getting rid of it is pretty high. Goes under the name of contravariant and covariant indices. But it's a cost you kind of have to pay to get to general relativity. And incidentally, from a pedagogical point of view, this leads to kind of a problem. So historically, relativity was built up through this complex metric. But in the end, it's not, it's great. It's much easier, and it solves any problem in special relativity, but it's not amenable to general relativity. So the question pedagogically is whether to introduce it in the first case, right? Why not bite the bullet and bring out the full covariant, contravariant stuff right at the beginning? And that's going to be the point of view of the Rindler book. And it is a compelling argument, but when I've tried to run it, it hasn't worked very well for the students. So this intermediate step of the complex metric, in the end we're going to throw out. It perfectly good for solving really any problem short of general relativity. In the end, we're going to, second half of the course, we're going to bite the bullet and get rid of it entirely. There's another kind of factoid that might be of interest. So the idea of the fourth dimension was kind of in the zeitgeist of the time. So H.G. Wells, which was writing before Einstein, had talked about the fourth dimension in his book, The Time Machine. But it's kind of not the right choice. So very commonly in physics, it's helpful to think about things in different dimensions, right? So a moment ago, I was doing geometry in two dimensions because it was easier but not fundamentally different from the geometry in three dimensions. And so similarly, it's often very useful to think about what relativity would look like in two dimensions or three dimensions or 13 dimensions, in which case the fact that the unusual dimension is at the end is kind of problematic. So pretty much these days, people would put the time dimension as the zero dimension. So just that warning in looking at other books. The fourth dimension will pretty commonly become the zeroth dimension. And so the thing that is unusual will have a fixed location as opposed to a variable location. Okay, so that's it for the first lecture.